Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis. And this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. We've got a real treat today. Now, I do love the history of shipwrecks, and I especially love the clever use of archaeology to recover artifacts. And then, I think most of all, I love the clever historical research that helps us understand objects and items that we are lucky enough to have recovered from the deep. And that's exactly what we're talking about today with the excellent Dr. Janet Dickinson. Janet is Senior Associate Tutor in History at Oxford University's Department for Continuing Education. And she is also Senior Faculty Advisor and Lecturer for New York University in London. Her research focuses on the nobility and the court in early modern England and Europe, and she has published widely on these subjects. Most recently, she formed part of an Anglo-Dutch project, Maritime Archaeology Meets Cultural History, focusing on the extraordinary objects retrieved from a 17th century shipwreck, in particular a set of drowned books. What do you say? Drowned books? Well, yes, that's exactly what we're talking about today. Janet is a member of the Steering Committee for Lord Burghley 500. That's a project celebrating the 500th anniversary of William Cecil's birth. Cecil, of course, being Elizabeth I's most trusted advisor. Janet tweets as William Cecil at Lord Burghley 500 and also as herself at Tudor Nobility. And I would urge you to follow her on social media. Today we are talking about these wonderful drowned books. Well, what is a drowned book? In August 2014, a group of amateur divers revisited a ship they had known about since 2009, one of a number of shipwrecks that they regularly explored. But this time they found that shifting tides had exposed much more of the wreck than had previously been seen, including a number of wooden luggage chests discovered near the main mast. Over the course of 2 days, they found around 1,000 items brought from the wreck, comprising textiles, women's clothing, furnishing items and objects related to life on board ship, many in a remarkable state of preservation. The divers also retrieved a large number of leather book covers, the remains of books packed into one or two of the luggage chests. Many of these were in a remarkable state of preservation, which have provided scholars with a glimpse into the world of trade and travel in the mid-17th century. Now, if you're listening to this, do please check out the Mariner's Mirror podcast on Instagram. Check us out on Twitter, where you will find images of these astonishing books. I'll also make sure that they are on Facebook and the Society for Nautical Research's website at snr.org.uk. By paying close attention to the manufacture and design of these beautiful books, we're able to gain significant insights both into the collection and the identity of its possible owner, as well as understanding better the international connections of books and their readers at this date. Now, dendrochronological analysis of the wrecked timber indicates that the wood used for the ship was cut in the winter of 1640-1. Taking into account the minimal times for the transport and drying of timber, as well as the building of the ship, it can't possibly have been at sea before 1643. We know from her cargo of palm wood that the ship was involved in trade with the Mediterranean, but that's enough for me whetting your appetite like the cover of a drowned 17th century book. And here is Janet Dickinson to tell you more. Hi, Janet. Thanks for talking to me today.
Thanks, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me about this wreck.
It's mysterious, I think is the best word. We know quite a lot about it now, but there are a lot of things that we'd like to know that we can't know without further underwater archaeology being done. So at the moment, what we know is that there's this sort of merchant ship at the bottom of what they call the Roads of Texel or the Reed van Texel. There's about 500 to 1,000 shipwrecks down there. So it's one amongst many. And it's a wreck that was covered over with a layer of silt. And then in around, I think, 2009, a local amateur diving team sort of came across the wreck and then monitored it thereafter. And they basically have been, you know, kind of intrigued by the kind of uncovering of this wreck as the silt levels kind of change and move in the area. So what they had by 2014, I think it was a wreck that was increasingly being sort of uncovered. And it seems to be sitting kind of, as it were, you know, sort of straight down on the seabed. So it might be a slight angle, but it really just seems to be kind of sitting there. And the upper deck has sort of got uncovered over time, and they realised that they could see some kind of objects which appeared to be some sort of chests or luggage or equipment of some kind around about the area of the main mast. And what they did was they kind of... It's difficult to know exactly what was going on because for them down there on the bottom of the sea, of course, it's really silty. The light is poor. You know, they're trying to see and they can't see terribly well. But basically, they found that there were a number of items coming loose, they say, and they kind of grabbed them and brought them up to the surface. Mm-hmm. So what you got then was a whole bunch of quite extraordinary items.
So okay. And a whole bunch. Give us some figures. I mean, I know there by a whole bunch, there's a lot, aren't there?
There's nearly 1,000, I think, ultimately, kind of individual objects. Some are fragments, you know, so they're not all fully intact, but there's a lot of stuff.
Considering the amount of wrecks that are there, it's quite remarkable that they chose this one to look at, and it was this one that has so much surviving material. It's very fortuitous, wasn't it?
It does seem... it's kind of romantic, I think, you know, in a way. I'm sure that they were looking at other wrecks as well. I think it's just this one seems to have been becoming uncovered. But what they brought up was extraordinary. I mean, the people in the museum there, the people that first saw these items, said it was like the Tutankhamun of the underwater world, particularly because they had these intact textiles. So they had this 17th century woman's silk dress that they kind of washed off on the dockside and then thought, OK, what do we do with this? You know, because it's not every day that you have a kind of elite woman's silk dress from the 17th century in your hands.
There's these anaerobic conditions, right?
Yeah.
So I suppose the silt or the mud stops the organisms in the sea from eating all of the organic material. Is that what's happened? Is that why it's survived? Such great detail, yeah.
Precisely, yeah. And then, of course, as soon as you bring it out into the air, then the process of disintegration begins. So some of the textiles, some of the other objects brought up, you know, almost immediately started to fall apart, from what I'm told. So, you know, there was a bit of an urgency there. So they did get in touch with the right people. They went to the local museum. It's called Capskill. It's a shipwreck museum on Texel. So they're used to seeing extraordinary and strange things being washed up or brought up. But they got in touch with experts at the Rijksmuseum and at the University of Amsterdam and, you know, got everything, as it were, you know, in a condition where they could start conserving it. And the things that I'm interested in, the book covers, these leather book covers, the divers told me about how they sort of pulled them out. They didn't know what they were. And as they brought them up to the surface, they saw this sort of pulpy substance washing away in the water, which we think was the paper, the pages of the books inside. So, you know, it in a way, it's a shame, you know, that they couldn't do a sort of proper underwater excavation. But at the same time, you know, these items dimensions were coming loose, they would have been washed away, they would have been lost. So, you know, it's one of those kind of moments, you know, where I'm glad we have what we have, but there's also that sense that we could have perhaps had more, or indeed that there's more down there.
Yeah. And so what you've got is an amazing collection of 17th century. Let's put a date on this wreck as well, 1640 yeah. something. Yeah? So mid 17th century book bindings, which are amazing. And yes. yeah, for people out there listening and who are thinking about the history of books, you might assume that all historians are interested in are what's inside a book. But that would be a mistake because book bindings are absolutely fascinating. They tell us an enormous amount about society at the time. They're an art form in their own right. What is it about book bindings that you enjoy so much?
Well, actually, I found during the research for this project, I found that a lot of people hadn't really thought about kind of ordinary book bindings, if I can put it that way. So that, you know, some of these are, you know, high quality, quite expensive, but some of them are really quite old. Most of them are 16th century bindings. So wow, you've okay. got something that went into the sea when it was 100 years old in the first place. They have terrible damage to them. They have all these little holes and kind of tears and little kind of worm trails through them, which when I first saw them as a, you know, not a maritime archaeology expert, I assumed was damage done underwater, but apparently not. It actually is woodworm damage from when the books were being used above ground. So when they went into the wreck, they were in quite a bad state, some of them. And actually, that's the thing that excites me about them, is that they're not a set of, you know, really fancy, expensive books on the shelf of a library. These are books which belong to someone who kept them for a long time, who maybe acquired them secondhand, who used them. You know, they show signs of wear. My favourite one is the one that has a little doodle kind of scraped into it, probably by a child. You know, it's a lovely, you know, expensive looking leather book cover, but someone's child or someone has got bored and they've just doodled a little bird into the leather cover. And I look at that and I think, you know, that's not the sort of thing you often see in a library. You know, it's not the sort of thing when you go into the Bodleian, you know, you see a book like that. This is something that's been used, abused, you know, it meant something in a kind of a human sense. So, yeah. you know, it was exciting when I first saw it.
There's a whole branch of scholarship around marginalia and around doodling in yeah. books, which I think is fascinating. But it's such a powerful way of reminding you that books of the time, you know, are really, they're organic. They are made of bits of wood, which is why the woodworms tried to eat them. The woodworms finding them tasty and is chewing them all up.
Exactly.
I do like the idea of them kind of just sitting on someone's desk and actually rotting or being eaten yeah. unless they're looked after properly. So how many book covers did you find?
Okay, this is where it also gets interesting, because we have definitely 34 what I call corporeal bookbindings. So that is something where you have maybe just a fragment of leather, but you have something you can say this was a book once. And then we have a further four what we call ghost bindings. And this is where...
A ghost binding? What is a ghost binding?
Ghost bindings, yes. A ghost binding is when you have a book that's been laying on top of another book within the chest it was packed in, and it's imprinted itself on it. So there was one binding, it's just a plain leather, small book binding, and I spent so long looking at these really faint designs on it, and I thought, okay, what am I looking at here? Why is it upside down? It was two heads in medallions, and they were clearly not the right way around, so I spent a lot of time thinking, okay, but that's the back cover of the book, how could that work? And ultimately, it became clear when we dried the bindings out, because they were wet at first. I looked at them initially, you know, when they were still wet, they were still immersed in water. And when I looked at a dry copy of it and I spoke to bookbindings experts, it suddenly became clear that we weren't looking at an embossed pattern at all. We were looking at the remains, the ghost of another book, which was just so cool.
It is. So, it's, you know, it's, it, I think it, it's the it, best it, thing I've yeah. ever heard.
when we also found, because books was fastened often with metal clasps in this period, we found kind of an angle, you know, where a metal clasp had got embedded into another book. So there you have this sense, you know, of this luggage chest with these books packed into it, probably not packed that neatly, or that, you know, moved in the wreck, you know, and it just gives you again that kind of human dimension, or that sense of almost capturing a moment in the life of these books, you know, that, that have travelled so far, a lot of them. Because
How were they dried out?
So they first of all were immersed in a solution called PEG, which is polyethylene glycol. And this basically...
That's what they've sprayed the Mary Rose with.
That's exactly the same thing,
for centuries, yes.
Yes. Okay. And the books were soaked in that for actually several years, ultimately. And that hydrates them, and that means the leather doesn't become brittle. And then they're freeze-dried, and then you get something which you can handle, which is very stable, you know, which is in a fairly good condition. So that's how they were conserved by the experts.
And where is the collection now?
It is in... it's in the possession of the province of North Holland. Ultimately, at least some of the book covers will be put on display at Capskill on Texel, but they are they're waiting for the museum to be built at the moment.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's hope that gets built and we can go and see them soon. How did you actually? So I love this idea of someone's pottering along as a researcher, minding their own business, and then you get a big collection of things that kind of falls into your lap that you weren't expecting, that no one was expecting, and that there's no kind of pre-existing structure for how to study. So how did you go about studying them?
You see. And it was actually even more panic-inducing than that, because when I began the project, I thought that we were looking at a collection of books belonging to someone connected to the Stuart court in exile, because one of them has a Stuart armorial stamp on it. So it seemed like this might be a royal book or connected to the royal family. Immediately learned this was not the case. That the bookbindings experts that we started talking to basically said, no, this is what we call a trade binding, a book bound for sale in a shop. So that immediately kind of, as it were, you know, destroyed the central assumption of our research. So then it just became a case of asking questions. And I think this was where this got really exciting in terms of historical research, was to actually collaborate, to talk to experts on bookbindings, to talk to maritime archaeologists, and to understand, you know, where these objects might be placed in a context to make sense of them. And people were incredibly generous, and their expertise was astonishing. And as a result of this, we were able to build up, or I was able to build up, a set of contexts for these books, for where the bookbindings had originated, for the rough date that they were created, and then sort of start to hypothesise as to how they might have ended up altogether in a shipwreck.
What were the hypotheses? What did you think?
Well, one question was whether or not it was a collection at all, whether or not this was just a whole set of books, you know, which were, you know, or not accidentally, but, you know, perhaps hadn't. a whole collection of books that belonged to an individual, or whether or not they were a collection of books that somebody had collected together and thought, okay, I can sell these. Books are easy to sell, make quick money, and I'll take them home and do that. And we still can't say for sure that they belong to a single individual, not least because they're so old and there's such a mix of origins. I mean, Poland, Lithuania, Germany, France, England, it doesn't kind of come together to give you a single monolingual owner. So it's someone potentially who could read multiple languages. The more I've looked at them, the more I've thought about them, the more I think actually this is a very personal collection of books, partly because it's just so random, the things that are here. So we've come to thinking about, could it have been a merchant? Could it have been a traveller of some kind? Maybe a young man going over to Europe to study, travelling with a tutor, picking up books along the way. They're probably not good quality enough for that, so that might not be the case. So we come to maybe ambassadors, diplomats, anyone who had a reason to travel and who might have had a connection in these territories, in these countries these books came from.
Yeah. Do we know? I mean, I'm assuming, I might be wrong, that it was expensive to transport something like books.
I believe so, yeah. I mean, we're talking at least two chests of books here. There might even be more down there still on the ocean bed. So I think it is somebody with resources to some extent. And if, we go with the hypothesis that they were intended for sale as secondhand books, that really makes it difficult to understand the ones that were in really poor condition, riddled with woodworm and so on. So again, that gives weight to the idea that it's a single owner. The other difficult thing about it, or the interesting thing, is that the latest date we can get the bookbindings to is around about 1620. The shipwreck can't have taken place before 1643 or thereabouts. So you've got a 20-year period there where someone apparently hasn't bought any books. I mean, that doesn't happen. We all buy books all the time if you're a book buyer. So did that person die, and this is someone's collection being brought home ultimately? Or the other hypothesis, which was a really interesting one, is that because books at the point of sale often aren't bound, or if they are bound, they might be bound in what's called parchment, which is untanned leather, that those books have disappeared altogether. So, the 20 years worth of new books has just vanished completely. But that's as far as we can take it, really.
Yeah.
The other thing that we can do a little bit of is actually attach them to initials. Because two of the books have owners' initials on them. One is MK, and it also has a date of 6-4, which is probably 1564. And that's possibly Polish-Lithuanian in origin. It's possibly also German or German. So that might give us an owner at some point. And the other one is the Stuart arms binding, that as that dried out, it became apparent that there was a set of initials on it. And those initials are TG. So if you can find me someone that was in a London bookshop in sometime in the 1610s, 1620s with the initials TG, who then went over and travelled on the continent and ended up on a ship coming into Amsterdam in around about the 1640s or onwards, then we could find an owner.
That's some challenge, but not necessarily impossible. I love this idea of someone moving, basically, or maybe someone died and all their goods are going back. So that really kind of brings into clear focus the fact that this is a period where people were moving around. There's a lot going on in the 1640s, isn't there? We talk a little bit about, trade in the 1640s and also the movement of peoples between Northern Holland and the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I assumed before I began this project that people wouldn't be travelling around because most of Europe's at war during this period, and it seems like an awfully dangerous thing to do. But, that doesn't stop people wanting and needing to make money and to travel for education as well. So,
to move around. I actually think war's a real reason for people to move.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. And I think there's a sense, again, with the number of shipwrecks that we have in this area, that an awful lot of people are coming in and out of Amsterdam under quite dangerous conditions, as we don't know whether it's the weather that sank the ship or whether or not it's some kind of aggressive hostile action that sank it. And either could have happened at this time in this location. So that's very exciting in a way and sort of terrifying in others. But the other thing that's interesting about this shipwreck is it's called the, it's known as the Palmwood wreck. And this is because it's got a cargo of palmwood on it. Now, this is not definitive, but it seems possible that this means it was coming from the Mediterranean, that it's got a cargo from the Ottoman Empire, say, coming in. Some of the textiles appear to originate from the Ottoman Empire. There's a flat cut man's coat, which is Ottoman style. There's also fragments, tiny fragments now, of wool carpets with designs on them that appear to originate in Persia. So, you know, it's a real mix of stuff. And it does indicate possibly, you know, if there is a connection between the textiles and the book covers, which I'm inclined to think there probably is, because they're all packed in chests together in the same part of the ship. But, you know, which we can't be definitive about until we know more, and unless we know more. But it seems like it could be someone, you know, who's been an ambassador out in the East and's coming home, or, you know, or a merchant, you know, that's picked up bits and pieces along the way and is bringing them home. It's really hard to be sure, but it does give you that glimpse, I suppose, of, you know, this kind of world in which the goods that are produced in the Mediterranean, these luxury items, you know, they have a big market that wants to acquire them. So they're being shipped around the place, either as cargo or as someone's personal possessions, you know, that they've bought along the way or accumulated. It's such a frustrating thing in some ways. We would love to think that we could find, you know, an insurance claim for this rather expensive cargo. And colleagues, you know, researchers have been looking, but so far to no avail. We really need we need the name of the ship. That's what we need.
Yeah. One explanation, of course, is it might be some kind of ambassador in the East, like you said, from Holland, who's been out there for 10 or 15 years, which is why he hasn't bought any new books. And then he's coming home.
Yeah.
Is coming home after his stint is done. Or I'd also like to think it was a merchant ship's captain's personal library, or the ship's library. There you go. It's a ship's library for merchants, for people sailing around all over the world. Give them something to read. I like that very much.
Well, you see, I was just going to say, I love the fact, actually, in a way, I mean, as a historian, I'd like to know who it belongs to. But as a sort of history fan, I quite like the idea that you can tell multiple stories from these books, that there isn't just sort of, here's someone's books and what was in them, that's where they came from. It actually opens up the possibilities. And I think that's the excitement for me.
Well, I completely agree with you. History is a much more creative discipline than many people give it credit for. And it's in the holes like this that I think history is the most exciting and it's the most challenging. There is no definitive answer, but that doesn't stop us asking questions of the past, which is, I completely agree with you. Well done. It's such a wonderful story of these books coming up from this wreck. Are there any other examples like this that people have discovered?
No. And that was really exciting as well. So I looked around, I asked around. The Vasa, nice comparable shipwreck, sunk in 1628, only 4 books on board. The Mary Rose, sunk in 1545, 9 books, but spread out across the ship. So they're sort of 6 of them were found within 5 lockable chests. So you know there that it's probably someone's private prayer book or something, you know, a single book belonging to a single person. This collection, there's nothing like it. There's the Stirling Castle, sunk in 1701, 6 books found so far. And the London, sunk in the Thames estuary, some really exciting stuff coming up from there, sunk in 1665. Few books coming up from that, but again, only in single numbers and spread out across the wreck. So nothing like this as an underwater collection exists. And it's also pretty difficult to find dry collections, as it were, you know, above water collections, because these aren't the kinds of books that you keep in a fancy library. Again, that idea that these are working books or someone's personal collection, that they're pretty scruffy in some cases, that, you know, there's a few new editions, but, you know, nothing too fancy. That strikes me as being pretty unique. And if someone else knows of anything comparable, I'd love them to get in touch.
Yeah, it makes you think about the nature of collections, because someone might be listening going, oh, well, of course, there are 17th century books in the British Library or wherever. You know, there are 17th century books in libraries all over the UK and elsewhere. But the point is that they might have just come as an individual donation. They're not necessarily part of a collection, and it's the collecting nature of it that makes it so fascinating.
Yeah, exactly so. And actually, the other very thrilling thing that came up in research was being able to match some of these books to some of these single books sort of dotted across collections. So with the Stuart Arms stamp, I was able to match that with a book in the Royal Collection at Windsor and a book at Cambridge University Library. Nothing similar in terms of their contents. One's a travel book about Venice. One's a rebound copy of an old Bible, you know, but the same armorial stamp was used, and we can be absolutely sure about it because there's a mistake with the stamp. The stamp has the Garter motto and, you know, on y soit qui mal y pense. And on the pense, the N is the wrong way round. So we have this brass stamp that a binder was using, which has the N the wrong way round, and he stamped these three books. And now we can reunite them and say at some point they passed through the same binder studio. And we have the exact same thing with a book in an archival library in Munich, which, again, it has slight flaws in the decoration that was used. It's a crucifixion scene and Christ rising from the grave. And we can match that exactly as well with the one small alteration, which is that the tessel example is 1 millimeter smaller because it shrunk whilst being under the sea.
Okay, but it does make you realise that you know, to make sense of these wonderful discoveries, that you've got to tap into the work of so many different scholars. You realise the importance of the network of scholarship. So you've got people who know about bookbindings, people who know about clasps on bookbindings, people who know about stamps, and you've got the archaeology side of things, the collecting side of things, the library side of things, and it does make you see how you know, scholarship really kind of fits in, and that's so creative and dynamic, working with other people in different fields, and you suddenly get something unusual which combines everyone's knowledge. That's why I like it. I think it's brilliant. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah, and I love it too. And I am so grateful to all those people that talk to me as well. You know, this has to be the way forward, that we talk to each other, we share these amazing discoveries, and we learn.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's wonderful, and I hope that we'll be able to read about it or find out more about this in the future.
Soon.
Okay, well, we'll come back to you as soon as you're ready to share. Thanks, Janet, so much for speaking to me.
Thanks, Sam.
Well, thanks so much for listening. Please do make sure that you find the Society for Nautical Research online at snr.org.uk, which is where you will find images of these wonderful books, and also all over social media, the Society for Nautical Research on Twitter and Facebook, and the Mariner's Mirror podcast on Instagram and YouTube. Particularly, the YouTube channel is rapidly becoming a fabulous repository of some really innovative ways of presenting the maritime past. Please share these episodes, share the podcast, tell everyone you know about this. It really, really helps. And please leave us a review on iTunes if you can. You can also get in touch with ideas. I've set up a strand on the Society for Nautical Research's free forum for idea proposals for the Mariner's Mirror podcast. But best of all, please put your hand in your pocket and join the SNR. Your annual subscription, it's not very much money, will nevertheless support this podcast and also help us publish the most important maritime history and preserve our maritime past.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.